This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, with lectures, features, and radio shows available online at sevillepodcast.com. On Wednesday, March 26th, 2008, the Culber Theater at the University of Virginia played host to In Search of America, a presentation of the Virginia Festival of the Book. The program is introduced by Rob Vaughn, president of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Lots of you know the Virginia Foundation because we run and produce this festival every year. But lots of you also may recall that we've done some things Irish. We have a member of the staff who grew up in Dublin and immigrated to the United States. We sponsored a film festival in the 90s on the reawakening of Irish film and the Irish film industry. In 2004, we brought 103 people from Ireland here, including the President of Ireland and any number of notables, along with 800 or 900 other people from throughout the United States and Canada, for the most part, for a program called Reimagining Ireland, and produced a film called Reimagining Ireland that premiered in Ireland and then premiered throughout the United States, and published a book on Reimagining Ireland. And that book is still available and still for sale. It was done by the University of Virginia Press on behalf of the VFA. So things Irish are very dear to us and dear to our hearts. This is the first of a couple of programs focusing on Irish. At 10 o'clock on Friday morning, we have the other Irish, a program on Ulster Scots writing. Ulster Scots, Scots Irish, the Scots who came to Ulster, now incorporated into Northern Ireland. They were always Scots, but came to be known as the Scots Irish or the Scotch Irish when they came to the United States in the 1700s. And that should be a really interesting program. This is an anthology of works in Ulster Scots. I hope maybe some of you will come for that one as well. And then we have Colm Toibey, who's speaking here at 8 o'clock this evening from Ireland, too. So Ireland is ever-present in Charlottesville. Tonight we're going to be looking for the Irish in America. And we have a wonderful group with us today. And Tim Humbert himself, an Irish descendant and director of the Chamber of Commerce, is going to introduce one of our speakers here, a friend.
Thank you, Rob. And as always, thank you, Nancy. Wonderful work helping Peter and everyone put this together. I was told I got 54 seconds left to introduce one of my good friends, Peter Quinn. Peter and I are recovering public servants from the emigres from the Kerry and Cuomo administrations in New York, and no desire to ever return to the public sector in any place called New York, particularly now. Peter's written a couple books, and he is a graduate of my alma mater, Manhattan College, and we have to get that in always. One of his great books is Banished Children of Eve, which won the American Book Award, and then a book which came out a couple years ago called Looking for Jimmy, which I've read, actually, and is quite good, and he's going to probably walk you through some of that. It's about trying to find the Irish American, the iconic Irish American of the 20th century, and I'll tell you who that is. It's a great book. It's such a good book that my dog really tore into it, so to speak. And so we're going to have Peter sign those books later, one with a paw print. But it is my pleasure to introduce my good friend, Peter Quinn.
It's nice to know, Tim, that you have an Irish Catholic dog. I did work for two governors, Mario Cuomo and Hugh Carey, which explains the condition of my head, that I'm bald. Half of it fell out in Albany, and I tore the other half out. I also had the distinction of, after I left public service, to work for Time Warner for 23 years. I just retired. So I lived through the AOL-Time Warner merger, and I saw my net worth decline by 90%. And I'm now reading the papers, retiring, realizing that I'm about to lose the other 10%. So if there are any job opportunities down here and you want to talk to me afterwards, that would be great. But, I think that's all very relevant because one of the best things ever said about Irish people in general, Irish Americans, was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. What's the use of being Irish if you don't know the world will eventually break your heart? And I think he should have, it's a great saying, but he should have added your wallet as well. We have four very distinguished guests, this is very surprising for an Irish panel, garrulous. I thought that I'd try to get through as fast as possible, which I have to revert to my New York habit of talking very fast. But I'll try to slow down in a Virginia kind of way. Of course, I want to thank Bob and Tim and most of all Nancy Damon. I was here 2 years ago and had a great time, and I tried to think of some excuse to come back and came up with this Irish panel. And I want to thank the four participants here. I'm not going to go in search of Irish America. They're going to do that. I'm going to take the easy road and sit in that chair. And they're a remarkable panel. But before I did introduce them, following up what Bob just said about Ulster Irish, let me note that I wrote Virginia's distinguished junior senator, Jim Webb, in the hope he could join us both to balance this collection of Yankee papers and to speak about his fine book, Born Fighting, How the Scots-Irish Shaped Irish America. I never heard back from the senator, a fact I attribute to the primary process that is continuing to absorb the energy and attention of Democrats everywhere. In the unlikely event that primary process should ever come to a final conclusion, it's my hope that at some future date we could have what I would call an orange and green panel. Instead of having an Ulster panel and a Catholic panel, that we'd have us all together, and that we'd include the Scots-Irish impact on American society, which includes eight presidents, Elvis Presley, and the James brothers, Frank and Jesse James, as well as William and Henry
William
James.
And Henry, yeah.
And now we have these four outstanding commentators on the Irish-American experience. And they all have very busy schedules, and it required a good deal of effort to get them here. Herding leprechauns, I think it's referred to. Up front, I'd like to acknowledge the cooperation of those who made possible this evening, the California Department of Corrections, the Sing Sing Correctional Facility, and the Massachusetts Women's Prison. And they want you back, Maureen. But they want you back. In alphabetical order, and they're going to come up to the podium to speak, we have Dan Barry. Now, that's Dan Barry. All those who came to hear Dave Barry are free to leave at this point. Dan's This Land column often runs on the front page of a local New York paper called The Times. Part poet, part journalist, Dan is an extraordinary writer. I think he's the best writer in American journalism at this point. And he's the author of City Lights and Pull Me Up, which is a moving and eloquent memoir about growing up Irish on Long Island. Musician, screenwriter Danny Cassidy, a native of Rockaway Beach, New York, known among the Gentiles as the Irish Riviera, has moved to the left coast, where he headed the Irish Studies program at the New College of California. His How the Irish Invented Slang is a stunning and groundbreaking combination of scholarship and street smarts. Former culture writer for the Boston Globe, Maureen Dizelle follows in a noble tradition of outspoken Irish women that includes Mother Jones, Sugar Puss O'Shea, and if you don't get that reference, then please rent Billy Wilder's movie Ball of Fire. And that other Maureen Dowd. Her book, Coming into Clover, is a must-read for anyone interested in the dynamics of Irish America. T.J. English is a genuine tough guy. I found that out the hard way when I failed to repay a debt and my kids went missing for 2 days. He's also a crackerjack writer who, along with his television writing, is the author of two New York Times bestsellers, both terrific reads, The Westies and Paddywhacked, the untold story of the Irish-American gangster, in which he refutes the Italian legend that Italians invented organized crime. We invented organized crime. All the politics and cheap entertainment. Before I set them loose, since we've been allotted an hour for the discussion, which is about how long it usually takes Irish Americans to clear their throats, I thought it might be best if we adjourned at the end of the hour to a local shebeen, where we can continue what I hope will be a very violent and passionate argument. And Tim Hulbert has suggested O'Neill's, right, Tim? Yeah, okay, so if you want to meet us there afterwards, we can continue this. Now, going in alphabetical order, each of our writers will speak for 10 minutes. On a facet of the Irish-American experience from his or her perspective. Dan Barry on the Irish American. Were you going to do Wall Street or the suburb?
Suburbs.
Dan Cassidy on the Irish American vernacular, in case you didn't know it existed. Maureen Dizell on what in many ways is the center of the entire Irish American experience and never gets the attention that it should. Irish American women, which kept the whole thing going. And TJ English on the Irish American underworld. We'll then go to your questions. And since this is an Irish event, and Irish events should be about talking, but they should also be about music. Dan Cassidy's we're gonna end with a song, which is the way you should end any Irish event. Funerals, wakes, or book readings. So with that introduction, would you please welcome Dan Barry?
Thanks for having me. I'm a little bit of what everyone else is going to talk about, and Danny Cassidy will get this. I'm kind of a mutt, right? That's the word. So I want to tell you a little bit about the suburban experience. A lot has been written about the city experience of Irish America. And so I grew up in Long Island on the South Shore in Deer Park, in a house that was called, the model was called a splanch. Does anyone know what that is?
Yes.
It's a combination of a split level and a ranch, and I don't know why the word never took off. It's so poetic. Splanch. But anyway, so in that, imagine this house. It's a not a very well-made house, mid-50s, built for, you know, all the soldiers returning, the GIs and such. And in the small bedroom, two boys. One incredibly good-looking, and me. The good-looking one would be my brother. So we're listening. There used to be things called phonographs, and they used to have records that would spin on these phonographs, and you'd put a needle down. And anyone know about this? And so we were listening to a record, and we listened to this record over and over again. My father would not allow us to listen to rock music, particularly the Beatles, because he thought that they promoted drug use. He would say as he was holding his Budweiser. And so instead we were listening to who? We were listening to the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. So I'm 10, my brother's 9. This is what we're listening to. We're listening to rousing anthems of war. And you feel free to join in. The minstrel boy to the war is gone. In the ranks of death you will find him. We're listening to the dirges of war. You're an armless, boneless, chickenless egg. You'll have to sit with a bowl to beg. Oh, Johnny, I hardly knew you. We listen to songs about alcohol. Misogyny, alcohol, and alcohol. Oh, moonshine, oh, moonshine, oh, how I love thee. You killed me own father, but dare you try me. Oh, bless old moonshiners and bless old moonshine. Their breath smells as sweet as the dew on the vine. I'm 10. So why were we doing this? We were trying to figure out, basically, who we were. How did we wind up here in this house, this splanch, on the South Shore of Long Island? Who were we, and how did we get here? And what was this all about? And so, of course, we have to go back. We have to go back to our parents, who really were puzzles to us. You never sat down with your parents and said, you know, so how did you two meet? You know, that just didn't really happen. We were watching Merv Griffin. There was no time for that kind of discussion. Right? So let me tell you a little bit about these two characters. And this is kind of a typical Irish-American experience, I think. My father was born in 1931 in New York. He lived in all four of the outer boroughs. He never lived in Manhattan. They wouldn't have him. And the reason he did was because his parents had a habit of not paying the rent. So they kept going from place to place throughout the city, one step ahead of the bill collector. My father once came home when he was about 8 or 9, and his mother was sitting on a couch, and that's a lovely scene, except the couch was on the curb, okay? They'd been evicted again. Hi, Mom, how's it going? Oh, how was school, son? So that was his kind of experience. In terms of, he spent some time in an orphanage. It was a rough childhood, riddled with the challenges of the economy for someone like my father and his parents. And how did he socialize? So this is how he socialized. He and his buddies, when they're 15, they would go into a bar and they would start singing. There was a wild colonial boy. Danny, take it.
You got it.
And so what would happen? It would be some old sot looking at himself in the mirror, drinking, and it would remind him of his dear sainted mother, and he'd send a pitcher of beer down to the lads, and my father was 15. This is how he would socialize, okay? All through that is the cleverness of the language. Also the communication through song, and going back to who they were through song. His grandfather, who was an emigre, we were very proud of him because he was a doorman at the Waldorf. This is the story. I don't even know if that's true. He could have been a doorman at an SRO for all we know. That was the story. We bragged about having a grandfather who was a doorman because he would bring home the leftovers, and this is part of the Barry lore. That's about all we had. Before my father, there was my grandfather. He died of alcoholism. Before him, there was his doorman. Before that, I don't know. It's a great something over on the other side of the Atlantic. You know, there was a great separation. It was like, we left that over there. This is pre-Riverdance, you know what I mean? It was tough over there. They didn't come over here and say, you know, let's go back again, back. It wasn't like that. Now, so that's my father. He goes into the Army. He graduates from high school at night, goes into the Army for 3 years. He volunteers. Always said he volunteered for Korea. So let's put him aside for a second, and he wouldn't mind that. And let's talk about my mother. Born in 1937 in Galway, she grew up in Gortmukka, which means it's sort of like the splanch of Ireland. It means, I think it means field of pigs, isn't that right? Gortmukka, and we love that, Gortmukka. But anyway, so she grew up on a farm. The marriage of her parents was arranged. It was basically a land deal, you know, go watch the field. You know, that's what it was like. And you know, it was the kind of place where, you know, the half door would swing open and a cow would stick its face into the kitchen, that kind of place. When she was 10, her mother died. When she was 15, her father died. And, you know, we always were told that he died because a horse kicked him in the chest. And that is the Irish way of saying he died of cancer, you know, because they couldn't even bring themselves to say the word. He got kicked in the chest by a horse. So what do you do with this young woman? Well, there were three other siblings. Let's pack this one off to a place called Brooklyn. And so here she is. She's 15, and she is packed off to some place in Brooklyn to an aunt who treats her as a scullery maid, which is, you know, part of the Irish experience as well. And I always wondered about that. You know, you go from a place that has, like, no running water, really. There's an outhouse, there's animals, and suddenly you're in Brooklyn, like, boom, and you're 15. So the story there is she goes to a church dance in the flatlands of Brooklyn, and there's some guy at the end of the hall there, and he's with his buddies, and what are they singing? There was a wild colonial boy. And off they go, okay? So they get married in 1957, and they have a beautiful kid. Again, my brother, but I was born before that. I was like the tryout baby. And so then they moved out to the island. When they moved out to the island from New York City, neither one of them knew how to drive. They had to take a train out to Long Island and have someone drive them around in the suburbs to figure out where they would live. And so essentially within 10 years, at least in my mother's experience, she goes from living on a farm to playing Mahjong in Long Island. You know, I always wondered about that. What was that? How startling is that transformation there? So as my brother and I were listening to these Clancy Brothers albums, remember, it was a different time. As I said, it was pre-Celtic Tiger, pre-Riverdance, pre-priest scandals. And there was a sense that we were Irish-American, but there was no need to prove it. It just was. And so that meant that when it was St. Patrick's Day and you went into the city, the children wore their suits and like their Easter dresses. I wore a dress, but that was a compliment. That was a rough year that year. But anyway, so now we're figuring it out now. We were Irish-American. We were the immigrants in our own way, coming from the tenement experience out to the suburbs and carrying these traditions with us that I don't know if we were really all that clear on what they meant, but we were the mutts. So now, my mother went back to Ireland only once. As I said, it was painful for her too. You know, we can glorify it all we want here in the United States, but if you were my mother, you would remember Ireland as a third world country, extremely difficult life. And so she only went back once, basically to make sure, you know, people remembered her, and then that was good enough for her. She died in 1999. And then my father died a couple of months ago, and I had to, he died in a vet's home on Long Island, and I had to clean up the effects. And, of course, I went into his wallet, and I carry with him now what he had in his wallet. That's my mother's immigration card right there. It's from 1953, and it says on it, you know, it has border crossing card on the back of it. I don't know why I carry it. We need our totems. We need these kinds of symbols. We need these kinds of connections to the past, I think. And I think that because of who my father was and who my mother was, I wound up as a journalist. My father was always railing against the man, against Nixon, against the powers that be that would denied him power. And so I had that in one ear. And then I had my mother talking to me in the other ear, and it was that Irish thing. And it was like, if she were to go to ShopRite for a quart of milk, it became a Homeric epic. You know, it was like 40 minutes, and she, well, what happened at the end? I bought the quart of milk. So let me leave you with as the table setter that I am here. My father and my mother now, he's Irish-American, she's Irish. They're sitting in the backyard of the Splanch. It's about a quarter-acre lot, and it's a Sunday. This is how it always was. And they're drinking beer, and they're listening to the Fordham station, listening to Irish music. My father is complaining about something. He's railing against Reagan. He's railing against Bush. He's railing against the powers that be. He's going off, and my mother was a master at this. She would say, oh, Gene, look, a cardinal. And it would knock him off his train, and he'd look over there. And then she would begin telling him this wonderful story about when she went to ShopRite and she got that quart of milk. And so there they are, and then it would be quiet. And then they would hear these songs. Some of these songs on the Irish radio station go back 200 years, 300 years, and there they are, Jean Barry and Noreen Barry, and they're here and there. Thank you.
I think one of the themes of this evening is going to be forgetting and remembering that the Irish have supposedly, I know when I wrote Banished Children of Eve, my family came in the famine, and the myth was that we wrote all the time and we were obsessed with our history. I didn't have a letter, no relic of who these people were, no memory of it. I went to every school I went to, from St. Raymond's Grammar School to Manhattan College to Fordham, was founded as a result of the famine. The first time I even heard about it was as a senior in Manhattan College of the Literature course, because what Dan was talking about, you know, was leave it behind. We're coming to America. My mother was horrified when she said, you're writing about the past, the Irish, you know, get on with America. That's excess baggage, she used to call it. But one of the themes is, you know, things persist. Even when you don't try to remember, the memory is there. It's like the moon pulling on the sea. It doesn't go away. It's not just in stories. It's in attitudes. It's in the way your parents hold you. And Irish America was filled with memories. And our next guest, Danny Cassidy, has done an amazing discovery of something that survived that we didn't even know was there. And it influenced all of American culture. It's, I think, one of the most important discoveries in American linguistic studies in 200 years. So here's Professor Daniel Cassidy.
Gorimilima.
Christian brother here, right?
I want him to tell me. I know. Yeah, thank you. The watch.
Yeah.
You're a wise trick. Guy, yeah? We'll get you later. Gorimilima hagiv. To awas moama ve. Agfela, Laura, Virginia. Thank you very much to all of yous. You, plural, agiv. To awas moama ve. I am so happy to be here at the Virginia Book Festival. Virginia, Ichabi Anguil Gabio, Fui Halif. Virginia, a place where Irish was alive, Fui Halif, underground. How do I know? Well, I'm here at Altskol, Virginia, University of Virginia. And there's a marvelous website called the Runaway Slaves website. I use it all the time. I use it, have my students use it. And as anybody that knows that website, the Runaway Slaves website, sponsored by the University of Virginia, it's been up for about five or six years, I think. If you put the word Irish in that website, hundreds of hits will come up. Are they slaves? Not really. They're called indentured servants. And they're running away in scores, hundreds, or as we say in New York, they're going on the lam. Lam, leap, jump. You like your jump bail, you go on the lam, lam, jump. They're running away with Africans, leather Irish, and they're in the advertisements. A tag, which was a, like Mick, you call someone a tag, meant an Irish Catholic. A tag named Patrick and his wife, Bridget, ran off today with Henry and Cuff, two African slaves, taking with them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And often in these advertisements for the runaway indentured servants, who were indentured anywhere from 7 years, sometimes to as much as 15 or 20 years. It was essentially slavery with a time limit, like going to Sing Sing for 15 years. But this was young women, children, et cetera. You essentially, the ads would often mention that doesn't speak English or speaks with a brogue that's can't be understood. In essence, they were Irish speakers. So the Irish language comes into Virginia very, very, very early and is underground and scatters underground and actually marks the speech of the South as much as it marks the speech of the Northeast. Certainly, we go down to New Orleans. 1762, New Orleans is conquered by an Irish speaker, Don Alejandro O'Reilly. Don Alexander O'Reilly, who does he conquer it for? Well, he's a Ganafiana. He's one of the wild geese who had fled Ireland, the Gaelic aristocrats and soldiers and mercenaries, to fight for who? Well, the people we always wanted to invade Ireland, the Spanish. Please invade us, please. Would you come? We're waiting. We'll light the fires. And he went off to fight for the King of Spain, and he went down to New Orleans in 1762 with about 26 ships and conquered New Orleans with all these buccaneers, wild playboys from the West, these wild Irish-speaking mercenaries. And so by 1860, 13% of New Orleans, 13%, is Irish-born. I didn't say Irish-American. 13% is Irish-born. Check the 1860 census. And then float up the Mississippi, well, you can't float up the Mississippi. Go up the Mississippi to Pike County, Missouri, and read about Huck Finn, and you'll read a vernacular that is covered with Irish and Scots Gaelic. There's literally these words are all over the place. So Irish is spoken in Virginia. It's been spoken in New Orleans. It's been spoken in Pike County in Texas, and certainly was spoken in Brooklyn, New York, and Massachusetts. That shouldn't be a secret, but it is. In December 2001, I inherited my first Irish dictionary, and it was not a happy occasion. A young friend of mine named Kevin O'Dowd from Philadelphia died at the age of 37 and left me a box of Irish books in his will. And it was the first thing I'd ever inherited, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. This young man had passed away. And I took the box of books home to my wife, Claire, and I showed it to her, and I picked up the little focal poker, actually, which I have over here somewhere, but take my word for it, it's about this big. Okay, literally fits in your pocket. Folkla dictionary poker, Folkla poker. And I showed the dictionary, the little Folkla poker, to Claire, and I said, you know, this is unbelievable. I said, but I'm going to toss this little Irish dictionary. The college library won't take it. I'm too old to learn Irish. I'm going to toss it. And she went, Danny, you can't throw that dictionary out. That's a gift from Kevin. It's sacred. And after 25 years of marriage, I occasionally listen to my wife. And so I looked at it, and I thought to myself guiltily, she's right, it'd be bad luck. You know? That's the Irish in me. And she said, why don't you put it on your nightstand and look up a word a night? What do you got to lose? I said, okay, I'll do it. And that's literally what I did. I put it by my nightstand, and a few nights later I wish I had the dictionary, but anyway, I began looking through this little tiny dictionary, which is actually much more impressive than it looks. As I said, it's minuscule. It's got 17,000 Irish head words, Irish, English, little grammar. I used to have to take my glasses off, actually, to read it. Oh, here it is. Thank you. My prop. Mm-hmm. Thank you, brother. There it is. 17,000 Irish head words in here. Irish, English, English, Irish, grammar, etc. And I began looking through this little dictionary right before I turned out the light. And then a light went on in my head. I had a hunch. Irish language, hunch, a perception, an intuition.
Now, some of the words and phrases that I'd grown up with as a kid in New York in a working-class Irish-American family, like in Dutch. Anybody know in Dutch? You're in Dutch with your mother? Meant you're in trouble. And there was the Irish word dush, trouble, in dush, in trouble. Or duking it out. We never fought with anybody in my neighborhood. You always duked it out. I had an Uncle Dookie. Why did they call him Dookie? Because he made his living duking it out in the ring with another slugger. Right? He was a boxer. And it said duking, origin unknown. And I looked in the dictionary, and there was an Irish word, duking. And what did it mean? Hammering, thumping, pounding. Exactly what you do when you're duking it out. And I looked at the word slugger, and it said origin unknown. And there in the dictionary is a word spelled S-L-A-C-A-I-R-E, pronounced slugger. And what did it mean? A mauler, a bruiser. Second meaning, a batter. Precisely how we use it in English. I said, this is impossible. This isn't possible. How could this be? Then there was the word we used to say uncle. Anybody ever know the word say uncle or cry uncle? You know, you hold your six-year-old brother in the neck hold, and you go, say uncle, say uncle. I used to do it to my brother all the time. Now he's got two black belts. I don't do that anymore. But yeah, say uncle. I always go, what do you say uncle for? Why don't you say aunt? Why don't you say grandmother, right? And there was the Irish word, A-N-A-C-A-L, pronounced, you ready? Unical. What did it mean? Mercy. Quarter. Figuratively, surrender. Say surrender. Say mercy. Say quarter. I said, this is unbelievable. And then my favorite word, snaz. Snazzy. When I was a kid, my grandma would go, I saw Mary in the street. Boy, did she have a snazzy dress on. Well, man, that car's got snaz. I love that word. They don't use it anymore. Snazzy. And I looked in the OED, Oxford English Dictionary, and it said, origin unknown, snaz, snazzy. And I looked in this little dictionary, and there was a word spelled S-N-A-S, snaz. And what did it mean? Polish, gloss, luster, class. I looked in the OED, it said snaz, polish, gloss, luster, class. And underneath it, the adjective, pronounced snazzy, snazzy. What did it mean? Polish, glossy, lustrous. I said, this is unbelievable. I can't believe this. And then I came upon the word glom, right? That was my nickname as a kid. My mother used to go, here comes the glom. I go, Ma, what do you always call me a glom for? Because you're always glomming other kids' stuff. I told you. Ma, where does glom come from? She says, I don't know where it comes from. What do I know? Go do your schoolwork. Ma, where does it come from? Maybe it's Yiddish. I don't. Ma, we're not Jewish. Where does it come from? And there was the word. Glom, in the dictionary, spelled G-L-A-M, a little fada, pronounced glom, meant to grab, snatch. Underneath it was my other nickname, the glommer, and there was the word G-L-A-M-A-I-R-E, glommer, a grabber, a snatcher. I said, wow, this is not, I'm serious, this isn't the first 8 weeks of having this little folklore poker, and finally I come upon a word you're all going to know, even those of you who don't speak the old vernacular, dude. I looked in the OED, says origin unknown, a factitious term that first emerges in the Brooklyn Eagle in 1883, related to the aesthetic movement in England and Oscar Wilde, meaning a fop, an overdressed person. Someone who apes the English usually wears tight trousers and smokes thin cigarettes. What the Irish called a dude, spelled D-O-O-D, D-U-D-E. Origin unknown. And I looked in the dictionary, and there was a word, are you ready for this, spelled D-U-I-D. And there was a whole bunch of other words. What did it mean? A foolish-looking person. A numbskull. Then I got a bigger dictionary. In Kerry, a clown, an idiot. I said, that sounds like a dude to me. A numbskull, an idiot. You know, somebody overdressed, which was how we used it. I said, is this possible? How could these words, no, I really did. I thought I was, I even told my wife, I said, this is insane. I was working on a film at the time. I'd been over in Ireland, actually, after Rosemary Nelson's death, and I was doing what most filmmakers do, spend 20% of your time making a film and 80% raising money, and I was raising money. And I said, Claire, this is amazing. Maybe I should do a project. And she says, yeah, well, look into it. But I knew one thing about Irish Americans, because I'd been teaching Irish American history and Irish studies for a long time and studying it all my life, because like Dan said, the only history I was raised with, I once was joking to a literary agent. I said, memoir's really hot. I said, I got a great idea for my memoir. He says, what's that? I want to call it Forget It, a memoir. He says, that's great. That's the title. I'm serious. My next book's going to be called Forget It. I mean, because, I'm serious. Forget It, a memoir. Because I used to say, Ma, where do we come from in Brooklyn? She'd say, forget it. I said, you can't even tell us where we come from in Brooklyn? Later on, I found out why. You know, my father, who went to the same orphanage, I think, as Dan's father, I'm not sure, was in Farmingdale. Mm-hmm. I only told one story about the orphanage in 1923 when the Ku Klux Klan came out and circled the orphanage. 1923. And I'd say, Daddy, tell us about the orphanage. Tell us that one story. I said, well, how did you get there? What went on? How did you lose your mother and father? Forget it. It was all forget it. So I knew that the Irish had forgotten a lot, including the language, and that unlike every other ethnic group in America, H.L. Mencken had written in the American language in 1937 that the Irish gave the American language, indeed, very few new words. Perhaps speakeasy, which is English, shillelagh, and smithereens exhaust the list. That unlike every other ethnic group that I had grown up with in New York, Puerto Ricans, Jews, Germans, Scandinavians, Sicilians, Italians, and they're different, every other group I know who had contributed loads of words to the American vernacular. When I saw a skinny guy at a dope deal on the corner, hey, there's Flacco, right? You go to the bodega, the guy's a schmuck, right? A lollapalooza, all these words that I grew up with, a tough guy, a stalker, right? Was Yiddish, Italian words. That unlike every other ethnic group in America, every single ethnic group, the Germans, the Irish were the only group that had contributed no words to the American vernacular. It didn't make sense, because I knew we could talk the wallpaper off the wall. And then when the wallpaper came off the wall, guys like Quinn and people, women like Dizelle and English and Barry would be writing on the other side of the wallpaper. We had Eugene O'Neill. We had William Kennedy. You know, we had Alice McDermott. We had the people on this panel. I knew we had some great, incredible writers. It didn't make sense. It was a mystery. But it was a mystery that had been confirmed by every single major dictionary editor from James Murray and the Oxford English Dictionary, started in the 1870s, Noah Webster, etc. That the Irish, when they came over here, had lost their language, and their children and their grandchildren, without a whisper, a trace, not even one tiny little scintilla of this ancient, literate language allegedly had survived, say all these dudes who had no Irish. While researching my own family history, my brother Michael, which was forget it, we finally did it in 1990, we got the courage to go in and start researching. My brother Michael and I discovered that my father was orphaned at age 3 in a place called Greenpoint, Brooklyn, Greenpoint, on the East River. We discovered that my father's family, the Cassidys, was speaking Irish in Greenpoint in the 1920s, along with hundreds and hundreds of other families in the parish of St. Celia's and St. Anthony of Padua in North Greenpoint, right below Newtown Creek, which is right where Queens and Brooklyn are divided, up in North Brooklyn. They were speaking Irish in the 1920s. And I go to my brother, but the only Irish I knew as a kid were two phrases. Maybe some of you know them, and we mispronounced them even in English. We knew Erin go brath, right? Ireland forever, and Pogha Mahone, or Pogha Mahone, kiss my ass. That was it. That's all we knew in Irish. Pogha Mahone, Erin go brath. Or Erin go brath, if you don't like it, Pogha Mahone. Ireland forever, if you don't like it, kiss my ass. So it was a mystery that I set out to look at, and that's how I got started on this 7 years of this project. 7 years. Am I a Lugan? Irish Lugan, halfwit. 7 years. Let me end on this. Why do I think perhaps I had this insight? And I do believe I have proven my thesis, and thankfully, some of the top Irish American and Irish scholars have confirmed. They think I've confirmed my thesis, too. I'm not bragging, because an Irish brag means to lie or exaggerate. I'm telling you the truth. Proven my thesis of a substantial Irish and Scots Gaelic contribution to American vernacular. Why was I the person that saw it? You know, I was the first person in my family both to be born in a hospital in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, 5 blocks from where my mother's family landed after the famine, and also the first person to go to college. I went to Cornell University. I was lucky enough to get into a good school. I had that, but I had one other thing that most of the people at Cornell didn't have. I truly was a native speaker of the old New York Irish dialect. I didn't have to watch old Jimmy Cagney movies. I didn't have to look in slang dictionaries. I didn't have to see Marty Scorsese's Gangs in New York to learn this idiosyncratic accent and this rich, colorful vocabulary. I truly was a native speaker of the old New York Irish-American vernacular. And I decided that, in fact, contrary to what Mencken says, it was snazzed up with the Irish language. Gora mila mahagiv, thanks to all of yous. Thank you very much.
And you should buy the book because one of the great things of it is the Irish vocabulary in it, which includes dawk and twerp and a couple other words you didn't mention. Our next speaker, when I was writing Looking for Jimmy, as a kid I'd always been brought up on the story of my grandfather Pat, who was a labor leader and went out west, and my mother's grandfather, who was in the Fenians. And we'd sit around and I'd hear these heroic stories about the men, and then it dawned on me, the people who kept the whole thing together were the women. You know, Pat was out there, had a proclivity to heavy drinking. His wife was Margaret Manning, who was the one who raised my father and took other cousins in whose parents perished. And she was a seamstress on the Lower East Side. And then there was my mother's mother, Catherine Reardon. And I write about them in the book. She came out at 16 as a contract and a maid in 1888 from Cork. And she worked as a maid for 15 years. And she learned everything about the great houses in New York, about silverware and what fork you use, a spoon. And she brought up her daughters so no one would ever know they were a maid. My mother was like, if she thought I was in front of an audience saying that her mother was a maid, they were ashamed of it. But it was those women, those Irish women, who went out and cleaned other people's bathrooms and made beds. You know, that happens. That's not only an Irish story. And they learned, this is how you live, and I want something better for my children. And time after time, especially in the 19th century, it was the women who kept it together and pushed the kids on. It was the women who worked as social workers, as nuns and nurses. And that there's an Irish America today, I think, is, you know, largely indebted to the women. So Maureen Dizell, who's written a terrific book about it.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, both Dans. And thanks, everyone. It's very unusual. 10 years ago, when I started working on Irish, the book Irish America, because I wanted to read it. Essentially, I became interested in my own heritage after moving to Boston and finding out. I moved around as a kid and lived in New York and lived in outside Philadelphia and in Ohio and had a vague idea of what my heritage meant. But moving to Boston in the 1970s and the early 1980s was moving in to one of the most tense periods of racial strife between blue-collar ethnic Catholics, in this case Irish Catholics, and African Americans. And to be Irish in Boston was to be presumed racist. And you could not bring people. This completely changed, entirely changed, particularly in recent years. But in those days, I taught classes of international students who at one point said, oh, take us to the parade. You're an Irish. You know, we would like to go. And you really couldn't do that. And this distressed me. It upset me for a number of different reasons. And I started to research the American Irish versus the Boston Irish, who the author William Shannon had called the world's most persecuted majority. It was okay.
This is the one that's working. We can't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, how's that? Thank you. All right. That was one thing I wanted to read. I also wanted to read a story about Irish America that was not about priests, politicians, and the police beat. It was to an astonishing degree that was the story. You know, the old neighborhood, the boyos, the fights, the violence, etc. You know, that was the Irish American story. That's nonsense. You know, the Irish American story has come up here twice, Dan and Peter, talking about those women who, not even women, girls, 14, 16-year-old girls, starting at the time of the Great Famine and going through with the early 20th century and then again in the 20s and again in the 50s, girls growing up in cottages with dirt floors sent over here as teenagers. And the next thing you know, they're serving Limoges, China in Beacon Hill and Upper Fifth Avenue, New York. They're going home. They're getting the kids to mass. They're getting the kids to school. They put a premium on education. They wouldn't let their daughters be housekeepers. Their daughters, who were far more better educated than their menfolk in this country, became teachers, secretaries. Starting in the 18th, 19th century, we don't know. There's a wonderful, rich history of Irish women union organizing. They were quite remarkable. They were overlooked, and not just in the home. And there's a tradition for this. I mean, this really shouldn't surprise any of us. And the Irish had no. You go back and read William Cahill's book about
Yes. The history, Irish civilization.
Somebody the Irish civilization.
Thank you. How the Irish civilization. That in Celtic, you know, Celtic literature and ancient Celtic texts, the women were warriors. They chose their own mates. They could divorce. There were women priests in Celtic Irish culture. There has never been a cult of romantic love in Ireland. And think if we can even come into, I'm sure there are a lot of readers of you know, the great Irish-born writers. Is there a notable work you can think of that ends with a man's voice summing things up? Yes! I've Lost the Playboy of the Western World, Juno and the Paycock, all of Yeats, women. Women speak, women summarize the culture. And that continued in this country. I mean, Eugene O'Neill, what did happen? I fell in love with James Tyrone. So there's a huge history. Ireland is a matriarchal culture, and that matriarchal became stronger here because when the Irish moved, as Peter has written about, from rural Ireland to urban America, the men had lousy jobs. The women were able to work in these homes and to educate their daughters and move further. They were almost a generation ahead of their brothers and husbands and so forth in education and opportunity in this country. The matriarchy became even stronger because Irish women have, in Ireland and here, controlled the purse strings. They also controlled education. And as I said, they were the link with the church. Speaking of which, when the Catholic Church built its own empire of parishes, schools, hospitals, social service agencies, it wasn't priests staffing those. It was nuns. So this was all simply not written about. And as a matter of fact, Irish women became something of a cultural construct. Mother McCree and I'll Take You Home, Kathleen. All songs that were written on Tin Pan Alley and for Broadway musicals, by the way. None of them had anything to do with Ireland, with traditional Irish music, or for that matter, with Irish women. Moving along. Irish women were not part, and I went into a lot, I did a lot of research. I could not figure out why this story had not been told. And as a couple of us have alluded to, I mean, the Irish did not tell. It was a terrible story. Nobody wanted to look back. It was awful over there. They left and they, you know, the most valuable people, some of the most valuable people on the face of the earth who can remain incredibly silent, notoriously silent about emotion and things that really matter. The story of women, where was it? Where's the sociology looking at the parallels between the matriarchal culture, pushing for education, holding the family together, the tie to the church? Sound like another group, perhaps African Americans? Now, where is this? Where are these strong women? Where are they in feminist history? Well, Irish American women were not part of the first wave of feminism, which in the 19th century, because for a variety of reasons. One was the concerns and the class. It was an upper middle class, abolitionist, white, privileged movement that pushed for prohibition, that pushed for birth control. That offended, and Irish women worked for these women. Again, the parallels with African American women in the second wave of the women's movement, sort of seeming like pretty logical candidates to be feminists, but shying away from this phenomenon, are really quite striking. And I do hope that there's more written about that, because the tradition, unspoken, you know, continues. Irish American women run a lot of things in this country. an awful lot of the – I started to catalog firsts, and I basically ran out of room. Entrepreneurs, law, journalism, you know, who are the – who have won – what women have won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in the last several years? Maureen Dowd, Anna Quinlan. Has Gail Collins won yet?
Not yet.
It's a matter of time. Anna Quinlan, Eileen McNamara, formerly of the of my former employee of the Boston Globe, first president of American Law School, Stanford, Kathleen Sullivan, Nan Keohane, media and multimedia, MTV, Judy McGrath, Hearst Publications, all over the place. Just take charge, get the job done, unsentimental, take care of it, and there's no such thing as an Irish-American princess. I think I'll end there. Thank you.
I'm picking up everybody's stuff.
Everybody knows about the Irish-American cop from television and fiction. Excuse me?
Cagney and Lacey.
Yeah, right, and women, right. I recently looked through the big book of pulp fiction, noir fiction, and just picking McCaffrey, Murphy, Higgins. You know, part of the Irish experience, the urban Irish experience, I experienced this as a kid in the Bronx was tough. You had to be tough. I was not tough. But that was part of the culture. And the Irish, as well as cops, the Irish are the first people policed in Western Europe. Before there's a police force in Britain, Sir Robert Peel introduces it in Ireland. The first English-speaking people to undergo the police. But the Irish were the cops in New York. The police force in New York had started in 1855. Why? To deal with the Irish. Well, the Irish were also the robbers. We have a vocabulary left over of paddy wagons and Mickey Finns and shenanigans and Irish confetti, which used to come off the rooftops. And the Irish role, really, as kind of quintessential criminals in the 19th century, which continues into the 20th century. And it's really only with Prohibition that the Irish role as kind of synonymous with crime begins to go away, and it becomes identified with other ethnic groups. And the Irish aren't alone. 1904, the police commissioner in New York, Theodore Bingham, writes an article in North American Review describing Jews as a natural criminal class. You know, crime still, for some reason we've never figured out, tends to concentrate in the poorest groups. And the man who's done so much wrote a terrific book, The Westies, which has been ripped off by several movie companies, I think, and then followed it with Paddywhacked, which is one of the best reads I've had in a long time on Irish crime. And TJ English has given us back the credit as criminals. So, TJ, it's all you.
Okay, a history of the Irish mob in 10 minutes. First of all, how many people here in this room even knew or know that there's such a thing as the Irish mob? Well, that's about 50% of the people here. The history of the underworld in America has been skewed in the last 30 or 40 years by Hollywood to give the impression that the underworld, the organized crime in the United States, is run by the mafia. Of course, there's a mafia, and the mafia is a very real thing and does exist and has been a factor in organized crime since the latter part of the 19th century. But the template, the framework for what we think of when we talk about organized crime really began before that. And it began in the shadow of the potato famine in 1845. And the famine is important not only as a historical event that touched off this long history of the underworld in America, but it's also the psychological key to understanding it, because the generation of famine immigrants who came to the United States were not only destitute, but they were psychologically scarred. And so you see in the earliest Irish Catholic settlements in Lower Manhattan, in the Five Points neighborhood in particular, you see the beginnings of a kind of a street psychosis that comes from a kind of deprivation and desperation that is very hard to define or even understand in this day and age. If any of you have read about the famine, you know some of the characteristics of what that was. You had a whole generation of young, starving Irish immigrants arriving in New York in the 1840s, and they began to form in various types of what we would now call gangs. Back then, it was a group. It was a street group, or it was a group connected to a political organization, or it was a group connected to a political club. I would humbly submit that you cannot understand the history of the Irish in America without understanding the history of the Irish American underworld, because the very avenues that the Irish used to achieve their greatest levels of success, the priesthood, politics, law enforcement, all of these areas of endeavor are deeply, deeply intertwined with the Irish American underworld. Again, it's one of these parts of our history that wasn't written about, has been buried away, and I think only in recent years has begun to bubble to the surface. And in a way, it's a testament to the Irish history, the Irish story in the United States, that because the Irish were the immigrants that came here first, and we've been here for 150 years, that we've now gotten to a place where we can reflect back on the gangster in the family, you know, Uncle Jack, who went away and they never told you where he went, but he's doing time somewhere. Or Uncle Frank, you know, who was a local ward boss who also took a long vacation. Or Uncle Sean, who died at a young age, and you ask your father, your mother, your uncle, what happened to him, and they tell you, well, he got hit by a train. He didn't really get hit by a train, but that's a euphemism that meant his life got hit by a train. He's probably in prison somewhere. So anyway, these stories are in the family history. It begins with the famine, and it starts in New York, and it spreads in a lot of really interesting ways. For me, this story began much, much later, in 1988. 1988, I was working as a freelance journalist in New York and driving a taxi in the evenings. And one of the stories that came to my attention was one of the prominent members of a gang in Manhattan, on the west side of Manhattan, in a neighborhood called Hell's Kitchen. The gang was called the Westies because the gang was based on the west side of Manhattan. A prominent member of this gang, Mickey Featherstone, who was really sort of a notorious figure in journalism circles in New York because he'd been written about quite a bit. He'd been put on trial for various murders since he'd come back from Vietnam in the early 70s. And he'd cut kind of a violent swath through New York City underworld and was a notorious and feared figure. And one day it appeared in the paper that he had been arrested for a murder that he was claiming that he didn't commit. And, of course, nobody listened to that because there was a lot of murders that he had committed and probably gotten away with. But he claimed that he didn't commit it, and he was going to prove it. And in order to prove it, he was going to flip, turn state's evidence against the gang, and he was going to testify against the gang. And, wow, this was an incredible story. It seemed like it was certainly the end of the Westies, which were kind of a notorious criminal gang in the 70s and 80s in New York. And maybe there was even more to it than that. So I went down to the trial during the day. I would go down to the trial, and I walked into the courtroom. This is 1988, mind you, not that long ago. And I walked into that courtroom, and the faces in that courtroom, and I'm not even talking about the defendants. I'm talking about people from the neighborhood who'd come to see the trial. These were a collection of the greatest, toughest Irish faces that you'd seen since a 1930s Jimmy Cagney movie. It was kind of like a lost tribe of Irish America, a throwback to something earlier. And so I became really enthralled by this trial and started going down there on a daily basis. And I could see the whole sweep of the history of this neighborhood could be told through what was happening with the fall of this gang. And that led to my writing of the book, The Westies. I eventually made contact with Mickey Featherstone and started a series of interviews with him and got to know him and got to tell the story of the Westies through him. And the Westies were, the first thing you need to know about the Westies is that they were an incredibly, savagely violent gang. They were known for cutting up their bodies and putting them in plastic bags and dumping them in the river and making the bodies disappear. They called it making their murder victims do the Houdini. And they had all sorts of humorous ways to describe what they did. But the level of violence and savagery was really dark. And a lot of it was internal violence. It was not even business related. It was just gang member against gang member. It almost represented a kind of self-immolation that was taking place. But the violence of it was just off the charts. I mean, you hear people talk about, oh, these Puerto Rican gangs or these Chinese gangs are so savage. Well, I don't know if there's ever been a criminal organization in the history of organized crime that was as savage as the Westies. And so that really piqued my curiosity. How could this happen? How did it get to the point of such extreme violence? And that's what led to me beginning to explore not only the history of the Westies in New York, but whether or not there were similar stories in Chicago or New Orleans or Boston that would give a key to understanding the full sweep of the Irish American experience in these cities. And so I began to do that research in New Orleans and in Chicago and found out that you could see these characteristics that were the same in all these different cities about the Irish American underworld. In all of these cities, it was connected to the political apparatus. In New York, we called it Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall was a benevolent association that of businessmen who sought to have influence over the political system. Tammany Hall became so all-powerful in New York that it was the force behind choosing aldermen, committeemen, assemblymen, all the various political roles within the political apparatus. And the criminal underworld was always intertwined with this. Illegal proceeds from gambling clubs and all sorts of vice activity that was allowed to take place, a lot of that money found its way back into the political system and was the juice behind a lot of the most powerful political figures in most of these cities in the latter part of the 19th and well into the 20th century. And when you look at this history, you begin to find these incredible, incredible characters. I mean, set aside the morality of it for a minute. Set aside the moral judgments that we might make about the paths that these people chose. You find the most kind of daring, bold, outrageous behavior within the underworld. You find the most desperate behavior. You find a gangster like Mad Dog Call in New York in the Prohibition area in the 1920s. Vincent Mad Dog Call, who'd been born in Donegal, a small town called Gwydor, come to New York and was orphaned and got into crime working as muscle for a more powerful gangster by the name of Dutch Schultz, and he eventually decided to branch off on his own. He was 18 or 19 years old, and he took on the entire New York underworld. He started raiding liquor trucks of some of the most notorious bootleg organizations in the city of New York. And outrageous kind of behavior. If you can compare it to what you might read about today, it would be, you know, you'll hear people read about an Irish American gangster or gangster activity in the Asian community or something in various cities, and people think, boy, this is crazy, reprehensible behavior. I'm telling you the craziest, you can take the craziest and most reprehensible behavior and you'll find an antecedent for it in the Irish-American underworld. You also find some great visionary Irish-American gang leaders in leadership roles. Oney Madden was another one in New York. In Chicago, you had a fellow by the name of Mike McDonald. They called him King Mike. He started as a gambling impresario and used the proceeds from that to pretty much finance everything that took place in the city of Chicago. He elected mayors. He owned a newspaper. Had tremendous power, tremendous power. And when you look at the full sweep of this history, you see that the dirty little secret is that intertwined with all the greatest accomplishments that we rightfully cherish and celebrate was the dark side, what took place in the streets or what took place in the smoke-filled room or what took place in the bars and the back alleys. This is as much a part of the Irish-American story as anything that you can point a finger to. And so this history begins well into the 20th century, and then the mafia comes into the picture in the 1890s and in the early 20th century. And then you get what I call in my book, Paddywhacked, the war between the Dagos and the Mix. And the war between the Dagos and the Mix is a narrative thread that runs through the American underworld beginning in the early part of the 20th century right up until, right up until the 1990s in South Boston with Whitey Bulger, who we can I think at this point safely say is, because he's still out there somewhere, the last of the Irish-American mob bosses. Bulger was the last of it, but I'll get to Whitey Bulger. But before we get there, the war between the Dagos and the Mix is a sort of gangland war that continues in many different forms over the next five or six generations, right through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and right up into the 70s. And for a number of reasons, the mafia, the Italians, take over the American underworld to an extent, and the Irish always saw criminal involvement in the underworld as a means to an end. It wasn't something, it wasn't a tradition like the mafia that you handed down from generation to generation. It was just something you used to get to the next stage in life, and it wasn't something that you normally handed on. It was something that was used as a means to an end, and so the Irish-American underworld began to die out as far back as the 1930s, really. The 1920s, Prohibition was the heyday of the Irish-American gangster, and then it begins to die out slowly. But you still have these some Irish-American gangster figures who never got the memo that the Irish-American underworld was dying out, and they continued this same kind of outrageous, over-the-top criminal behavior right into the 70s and 80s. In Cleveland, Ohio, there was a gangster in the 70s by the name of Danny Green. Danny Green was obsessed with the image of the Celtic warrior, and he was obsessed with his own Celtic heritage. And so he had everything in the color green. He drove a green car. He wore a green checked sports coat. Yes, he did. I've seen pictures of it. He wrote with a green ink pen. He was obsessed with it. And he became a one-man wrecking crew in the Cleveland underworld of the 1970s. He took on the mafia in a bombing war, a tit-for-tat bombing war. And they tried to kill him numerous times, blew up his house. And he opened up a club called the Celtic Club, and he'd sit out in front of the club with a beer in his hand, and the news reporters would interview him, and he'd say, "Hey, I'm right here in front of the Celtic Club. If they want to try to kill me, they can come here and get me. I don't care about those Italian maggots." I mean, he would really take them on. And he eventually got blown up. he did get blown up. On his way to his dentist to get a filling fixed in his teeth, he got blown up in the parking lot. But that was into the 70s, and then the Westies. The Westies existed right into the 1980s, and the Westies were like a throwback to another generation. They had links going all the way back to the 1920s, and they inherited a lot of the criminal traditions that had by then died out. I mean, the Irish in New York had begun to wane noticeably in the 60s and 70s. And so by the time I started to cover the Westies, you could see that this was a tradition from another generation that for some reason had existed and continued long past its expiration date in the neighborhood of Hell's Kitchen. And then right up until the final chapter of this story, which took place in South Boston with James Whitey Bulger. And if I don't know how many of you here are familiar with the story of Whitey Bulger, but he's, I think, the number two man on the FBI's most wanted list, number two behind Osama bin Laden. Whitey Bulger was the brother of William Billy Bulger, president of the Massachusetts State Senate, probably during his reign the most powerful politician in the state of Massachusetts. And so within the relationship of Whitey and Billy Bulger, you can see almost the entire history of the Irish-American underworld, the connection between the political apparatus and the underworld, and also law enforcement, because Whitey Bulger was also an informant for the local FBI office, an FBI agent named John Connolly, who grew up in Southie. So in that story, you have the lawman, the politician, and the gangster all intertwined, and it's really remarkable how that history, that strain, had remained so strong right through the entire 20th century, right up until the 1990s. And they finally caught up with Whitey, but he saw it coming. And for years before they came for him, he'd been traveling around the world, and he'd deposited money in bank accounts around the world under pseudonyms, under different names. And so when the time came, and Whitey was tipped off by someone in the FBI office, and so he was able to disappear into the wind on the lam, as Danny would say. And he's still out there, and there's occasional sightings of him every now and then. You'll see it in the news. But as far as Whitey's still out there, he's sort of like a ghostly reminder of this incredible history that is, although troubling and disturbing and dark in many ways, it's so illuminating in terms of understanding the Irish-American story and the American story. So I hope you'll, along with our celebrations of the great priests and the soldiers and the women and everyone that's contributed so much to this history, take a look at the dark side. I think you'll find it very elucidating. Thank you very much.
Is this right? Is it 20 after? When you say Whitey is still out there, you don't mean out here.
Right? In the audience.
Could be.
Just a footnote on Vincent Cole, who was, because what TJ referred to as the post-famine Irish experience, and there was this tradition of violent resistance in Ireland. He was from the village of Gweedore, Vincent Cole, which, as Danny went to, was an Irish-speaking village. He was raised as an Irish speaker, this great gangster in New York. Other groups from Gweedore and Donegal were the Molly Maguires, which is the largest mass hanging, one of the largest mass hangings in American history, a labor organization, and the Invincibles, who assassinated Lord Cavendish in Phoenix Park in 1888. And I think that goes, you know, William Kennedy has written these terrific novels. Danny and I were with him last week describing this O'Connell machine in Albany, which ran the city for, you know, they had one of the great, I think one of the great mottos of any political machine, honesty is no substitute for experience. and there are people, post-Governor Spitzer, a lot of people are agreeing with that. William Kennedy said, you know, there was only one crime for the Albany Irish, and that was to go hungry. And anything that prevented that crime from happening was acceptable. I think we're going to, I want to open the, are there any questions? I have one question, which is, you know, I think this experience that we're describing, one of the things I was writing about this book is it's over. The Irish-American experience really went from the famine until the 60s. We lived in these neighborhoods. We stayed in these parishes. We stayed in certain jobs. When I was a VISTA volunteer in Kansas City, it was the first time I'd ever left the Bronx. I met kids from California, Chicago, Seattle. We all had the same education. That was not true about public kids in public schools. We had the same exact catechisms, textbooks, English textbooks. We were such a cohesive community. I could sit down with somebody from San Francisco. We'd had exactly the same. We talk about what order of nuns we had. That was not true of people from outside our experience. And that's over, essentially. So I'm just wondering where, you know, in 5 seconds, where does it go from here? One of the things I've always thought that keeps ethnic groups together is not self-love. You get inside any ethnic group and it's just civil war. It's fear of the enemy. And is that, the enemy's gone for our, you know, there's nothing, we're in the White House and corporations, so there's nothing to, is this the end? There's never going to be a panel on Irish America? Anybody want
to? I'll kick in. I would have a little disagreement on that. I do think that roots are important for all people in America. One of the things that Alex Haley was doing when he first wrote Roots, the famous African-American tale of African-American roots, before he died, was working on a second book, also about roots. Only his second book would go back to Ireland. Alex Haley was a member of a group that has been left out of the Irish-American experience, and I estimate makes up as much as 10 to 12% of our community, and that is the real black Irish, the Irish African-Americans. There was a whole neighborhood in New York City in the 8th Ward, a whole neighborhood on Sullivan, Lorenz, Thompson Street, Spring Street. In the 1870s, 12% of the African-American community was Irish African-American. So I think roots are important not just for African-American people, but for so-called white people. I always tell my students there's two words you can't call me. One is dude, but the other, and I am deadly serious with this, I'm not joking, white. Do not call me white. You can use the word white if you wish to parse racism based on skin color. It's a perfectly legitimate term, and it helps open up that horrific chapter, ongoing, I might add, in American history. But in terms of roots, in terms of culture, forget it. Don't call me white. There ain't no vitamins in being white, folks. I don't know. You know, when I was a kid, the only people that identified strongly white were the Ku Klux Klan. Now you have these I'm in college with these progressive professors. I'm talking about whiteness all the time. Well, let me tell you, there are no, if you want to pass whiteness on to your kids, go ahead and do it. But really what you're passing on is Britney Spears and this toxic culture that we see on television today. And I think that so-called white people, and that includes Irish American people, need to get into their roots to provide us with the kind of cultural, historical vitamins that we need to survive as people holistically. And that this is something we need to quit forgetting about it and to remember.
Yeah.
Okay, I actually have some data, okay, that I dug up from a variety of when I did the book about the another unsung. I mean, Irish Catholics in the United States since 1960 or 1970, and Andrew Greeley at the University of Chicago documented that, have been the, since the early 70s the second most highly educated and prosperous American white ethnic group. Doesn't go with the stereotype, but it's true. And it's, you know, and this was based on some of them. Irish Americans live side by side with well-to-do Protestants in the toniest suburbs, play golf at the most exclusive clubs. Since at least the early 70s, they've gone to the same universities and grad schools, held the same managerial and professional jobs. Studies show that Americans of Irish and English descent drink comparable amounts of alcohol, that is, more than most others. They share a peculiar fondness for well-made casual clothing emblazoned with extraordinary designs, such as green whales on blue backgrounds. But according to the Harvard Encyclopedia of American Ethnic Groups, even three or four generations removed from the motherland, Irish Americans score consistently higher than most others on measures of sociability, localism, trust, and loyalty. They tend to be gregarious. 38% drink with friends at least once a month, et cetera, et cetera. 35% of Irish Catholics, as opposed to 30% of other Catholics, belong to a church-related organization. We like to laugh. We give into explanations, like, it's terrific. We remember and use other people's first names. People put us next to strangers at weddings because we know how to talk and ask questions. We're phenomenal organizers, and in the secular trinity of Irish American values, loyalty and humor, our father and son, self-deprecation is the spirit that works in mysterious ways. And one of the most flattering things that can be said of an Irish American woman from her point of view is she is one of the most down-to-earth people you ever meet in your life. For men, he's a regular guy. That won't go away, I don't think.
Yeah, to pick up on what Danny said, I think where Irish Americans are now is it's kind of a good news, bad news scenario. The bad news is that at least 50% of Irish Americans, or if whatever that means, I mean, most Irish Americans are a mixture of a number of different things, but at least 50% now have moved out of the cities and they've assimilated to such a degree that they're just white people. They're Americans. They're white people in America, and they've lost all touch with their ethnic roots. And we all know, we've all met O'Learys and Kellys, and they hardly know that they're Irish at all. I mean, I have some members, I come from a big family. I have members of my own family that they left it behind. It really doesn't seem to mean much to them. On the other hand, I think after this process of 150 years, that the other 50% of us are at a wonderful period of self-reflection, where because of the history is mostly behind us, and we're dealing from a place of self-assurance and great accomplishment, that we don't have to be defensive about things like the gangster history, for instance. Mm. When I went out on the book tour for the books that I do, I don't get what a lot of other ethnics would get in relation to writing about the dark criminal members in the family tree. You don't get that. You know, the Sopranos, Italian Americans were up in arms about this show, The Sopranos. Mm. I mean, I think if you published a book on great Puerto Rican gangsters in history or great Chinese gangsters in history,
there would be
an uproar about that. The Irish have gotten to a place where they don't have to be defensive about that anymore, because we were the first. And so I think what we have is this wonderful opportunity to sort of engage in a kind of self-reflection and self-examination that in many ways is a gift to everyone within the mosaic of the American experience.
Right. And hopefully will be the model for all groups, Spanish, African, that they, you know, there's something not bad in melding, I think, but you have to bring something with you to meld.
But the idea that you'll get to a place as a people where you can reflect back honestly, right, to take the good with the bad, an honest level of self-reflection without the shame and defensiveness.
I always tell people.
Bob is here. I think it's time to go, but we're just going to end with a song, if that's
okay. Okay. Real quick.
All right. He's going to take us back to the beginning, which is this is one of the oldest Irish American songs, and it's an amazing story. So, let me get us
out of my middle class drag. Forget it. I'm a dude.
He's a dude.
All right, and then we'll be out of here, Bob. All right.
Well, this is one of the most popular American work songs and folk songs. It's called Pat Works on the Erie. but also it's a sonnet lay, which in Irish means the secret song. And we're going to look at the secret right now, in a short version. In 1841, I pulled me corduroy breeches on. I pulled me corduroy breeches off to work upon that railway. We sang Philomé O'Reilly, Philomé O'Reilly, Philomé O'Reilly, to work upon that railway. Now, there are many versions of this song scattered all across the mid-19th century Irish diaspora, from Liverpool to New York to San Francisco to Melbourne, Australia, wherever Paddy bent a back and laid a track. In fact, in Pennsylvania, it is said that every mile of railroad is an Irishman's grave. Recently, a team of archaeologists from a college in Pennsylvania uncovered a mass grave at Duffy's Cut, with 57 Irish railroad workers in it, victims of cholera, typhus, and violence that plagued poor Paddy, working on a railway. And we sang Philomé O'Reilly, Philomé O'Reilly, Philomé O'Reilly, to work upon that railway. Now our contractor's name, it was Tom King. He had a store to rob the men. A Yankee clerk with a fountain pen to cheat Pat on that railway. From the 17th century to the 1920s, 7 million Irish people, half of them women and girls, immigrated to the crossroads in North America. Spalpeens, migratory workers. Colleens, girls and maids, looking for work and for freedom. In other words, Paddy was a working stiff. In the Irish language, the word stiff, S-T-A-F, means a broad-shouldered, brawny person. They built the railroad, the Yarn Road. They built the highways, the Balmore. They built the bridges, Brishti. They built the infrastructure of modern America. Philomé O'Reilly, Philomé O'Reilly, Philomé O'Reilly, to work upon that rail. Now the phrase Philomé O'Reilly for 160 years has been treated as nonsense syllables for the academics in the audience, macaronic. Liam Clancy sung it, Pete Seeger sung it, Bruce Springsteen did a version. Macaronic, mere nonsense. In fact, Philomé O'Reilly is the hidden litany of labor, sung in Paddy's other tongue, Irish. The first literate language in Europe, after Latin and Greek. In fact, Philomé O'Reilly is the hidden litany, the sanasle, the secret song of the working stiff, of rising and working and working and rising, and we're going to translate it now for you, and then end. Philomé O'Reilly is merely the phonetic version of the Irish phrase Philomé O'Reilly, meaning time to get up. I'll go back. I'll go back to work. I'll go back to work on the railroad, to scrubbing the floors, to build the bridges, to dig the ditches, what my grandfather did for 50 years. What my grandmother scrubbed floor. Philomé O'Reilly. And that's the roots we need not to forget. Philomé O'Reilly. Time to get up and I'll go back. 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 Time to get up and I'll go back to work.
Thank you. All their books are all for sale outside, and I think we're going to O'Neill's, right, Tim? So anybody who wants to...